So let's move on to the meat of what we're doing today. And if I can just say, and I'll just speak for myself and not for the whole board, but I think this is a really, developing this academic framework is incredibly important. I think we're charged in our strategic plan with identifying high-performing schools, high-quality schools, so that we can encourage them to expand, so that we can encourage them to replicate, encourage them to disseminate information to their peers so that others can follow their same practices, so that we can increase the quality of the overall portfolio of charter schools underneath this authorizer. And I think also when we identify those schools, it's important that as part of our strategic plan that we, to the greatest degree possible by law, that we relieve high-quality schools of many of the bureaucratic... It's working. This is. Anyway, as I was saying before the bureaucracy fought back, that we relieve high quality schools of as many of the bureaucratic requirements as possible. And ADE requirements as possible, and also that we streamline as many of our processes as we can, again, to the end of trying to make things easier for high-quality schools and allow them to continue to do what they're doing. On the other side of things, we need to make sure that we have a framework that is a valid and reasonable framework for identifying schools that are not increasing pupil achievement so that we can encourage them to get the help that they need in order to turn things around, and if they don't, that we can put them out of business, and or at the very least, we can make it more difficult for them to expand, replicate, and so on. So I think in the past, we've operated on kind of the seat of our pants a little bit on trying to, on using the state labels, I mean, things that have been alleged to be valid measures, but using state labels, growth percentiles, raw pass rates, in a way that was well-intentioned, but probably not as sophisticated as our framework should be. So I gather that what we're doing today is trying to get a valid and sophisticated measure of school quality, and I'm excited to try to pull that off.
Thank you. If I may then just jump in, you took care of a couple of my opening comments, so thank you very much. I would like to say that while we I would like to go on record as your executive director as saying that we have not been operating by the seat of our pants, but rather have had a very systematic process for which we have been providing you with your materials, and that you have been following your statutory requirements and your strategic plan as it's been set forth. And I appreciate that you have done that. But I do recognize, and we all recognize, I think, that there were processes that could be improved upon. We saw that with the NAPSA evaluation. We saw that with your own efforts in developing your strategic plan. And I think that you recognize that when you directed me to apply for the NAPSA implementation grant, which is the funding that has been used to develop this process. So you may remember that you've already developed and adopted your financial framework. This is the next piece of the puzzle. It's the academic framework. We have been working for a long time, although, and I've been talking to you about this committee meeting for a long time, and that we'll be ready. Well, today we are actually ready. We've been working with Katie Peel, who is the Director of Authorizer Development for NAPSA, and she is here today. We've also been fortunate enough to have the assistance of Larry Abose with Public Impact. And of course, the Arizona Charter School Association, Ildi and Annabelle, have been instrumental to the development of this framework as well. In addition to that, in the setting the foundation, and once the materials were at a level where we felt like they were ready for public review, wanted to let you know that in the last week, I also had the opportunity to hold three focus groups. I met with representatives of the Alternative School Consortium, and another representative from a large alternative school group. I also had the opportunity to meet with small schools. I had invited 15 small schools to a focus group. I had two attend, but they put on multiple hats and shared information as they could, as they thought it related to a variety of small schools. And then also invited 30 schools to the traditional schools to a focus group as well, for which I had 5 schools represented. So, and again, each of them provided the feedback if they could. I had the opportunity to discuss that feedback with staff, with Lyria, and with Katie, and with the association, and incorporated or talked about why, when the focus group said one thing, why we would go that way or why we wouldn't go that way. I think ultimately, in understanding that we are still limited in the data that we have, in as much as it's the AIMS data that we have, and that we thought long and hard about the different ways that you could evaluate AIMS data, and that's what has been presented to you. Some of it looks a little bit like the criteria through the A through F letter grades, but some of it is different. Certainly there were probably 100 other ways or more that we could have presented data, or we could measure our schools as well, but we believe that what we're presenting to you today is a logical, methodological approach to the evaluation. And we look forward to your feedback and the feedback of the stakeholders who are attending. You'll notice on your agenda you've got a lot to do today. We hope that by the end of the meeting you will have decided upon the measures that you would like to present to the full board for inclusion in the academic framework for a traditional, a small school, and alternative school framework. We hope that you will also come to some consensus about what the threshold should be for each of the measures included in those frameworks. And then what you have in front of you today as part of your materials is a guidance document, very much like the financial framework. The guidance document will be the public materials that will be available for an understanding of what this framework means and how it will be used. It's a very draft version now. There are some gaps in the materials that just couldn't be developed until we knew which direction you were hoping to go, but we certainly have a lot of suggestions and some ideas for you on how you might do that. And then we should talk about how you want these materials, once you decide what the framework is going to look like, how you want those presented in your materials when you receive them for consideration. And then ultimately, when we get finished, just as we did with the financial framework, we need to determine what changes you would like incorporated in the renewal application. And we have some ideas about that as well. So I know I have you until noon today. That's the plan. And so I'm going to go ahead and suggest that we start with the presentation by Lyria and Katie, who can walk us through the entire process. We have been very thoughtful in the way that the PowerPoint is structured. We hope that it will answer a lot of your questions as we go through it. And so if you have burning questions, certainly you're welcome to jump in and ask, but we think that we'll cover a lot of it if you allow them to go through their entire presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for inviting us here to talk with you today about the Arizona State Charter School Board's proposed academic performance framework. Today we're going to walk through some how we got here to this point and some bigger picture things that got us to this spot, as well as discuss and get into some big details about the academic performance framework, and also discuss some next steps with you. My name is Katie Peel. I'm the Director of Authorizer Development for the National Association of Charter School Authorizers. I'm joined with Lyria Vost, who's a research consultant with Public Impact, who's been working with us on this project from the beginning. And we will, we're happy to share with you the process that we went through today. I'm going to talk about a little bit of background and orient you all to the larger purpose of the authorizer work that you all do. That includes the strategic plan that has been discussed already, that you all have adopted, as well as the BACSA evaluation that was conducted, which was part of the impetus for this project and this development of the performance framework. Then I'll discuss the academic performance framework in detail. We'll discuss the modifications for, we're going to actually move that up and discuss the modifications for alternative schools after we discuss the alternative for the academic framework itself. And then we'll walk through a summary of the trial run analysis that has been conducted to help kind of support, verify the measures, and when needed, make adjustments, which is the purpose of that analysis. And then we'll discuss the overall weighting of the framework. So keeping all of that in mind as to how we're going to discuss the entire framework in general, we'll have a lot of details to get through, and then we'll be able to talk about the individual questions of each piece of the framework, but I want to be able to provide you with a big picture first. So just to give you a little bit of background, you're all familiar with the work that you do as authorizers. There is a charter bargain that we reference in the world of authorizing, the world of charter schools, where you have increased autonomy to do and implement the programs as you see fit as a charter school. And you're held accountable for results. And in that bargain, in that way, we view that ultimately that we have improved student outcomes for the public. And the idea is that that we get to that point of improvement and of academic performance. Authorizers are charged with two main things. Their purpose is to improve the educational options by approving only strong, viable applications, as well as renewing schools if they meet or exceed performance expectations. Just to kind of drive down as to what your role is, from a very big picture, you've got two major decision points for schools. You approve new applications, and you renew schools that are doing well, meeting or exceeding expectations. And what we'll talk about today is a little bit around how you define those expectations, which is a critically important piece to this authorizing process. But again, bringing it up to the big picture of what your role is overall. The performance frameworks that we talk about are really a backbone of the work that the authorizer does. They're the elements that get included in almost every aspect of the work of authorizing. And at the beginning, they're part of how you establish expectations so that there's clear transparency of performance expectations. What we see nationally or generally is we like to have these expectations attached to the contract. It depends on the national, or it depends on the state context to know whether or not that's appropriate. But we ultimately use these tools to monitor school performance, conducting interim reviews, intervening when necessary. If there is a case where a school might be performing unsatisfactorily, then you can, prior to any kind of high stakes point, you could communicate that concern to the school. And then, of course, that renewal period where you assess the overall performance of a school in relation to the established expectations. And also, as has already been discussed this morning, being able to use this information to help guide your decision making on replication and expansion, for example, as well. We've developed a tool that is rigorous enough so that you can really call out both areas where you have to take action on a school if there's a performance that is not up to par, but also being able to take action and support schools that are really doing exceptionally well in serving the public and the students in your community. Just to give you a quick background and recalling back, this is just a reminder of the NAFSA evaluation that was conducted and the summary of the findings of that evaluation. In the key competencies area, we identified that your new application requirements and your evaluation criteria were solid. You've been moving towards a performance-driven authorizer format. The performance management plans are a great step. So this is just kind of a continuum of this movement that you have already started, especially given your strategic plan and the direction that you're headed based on that. And that you provide student schools with autonomy. And that's, remember, that's a key element of the charter bargain. So that's an important piece to make sure that we recognize and protect. The priorities that were established for improvement from that evaluation include applicant capacity interviews. I'm just noting that because that was a piece that was an element of the implementation grant that is also why we're here today with the performance frameworks. But then also some other areas for improvement were, you know, developing performance-based contracts with the emphasis on the performance-based on that. As well as increasing and improving oversight of financial performance. We've already seen some strong action by this board on that, in that area, to kind of shore up some analysis and some guidance on how to assess financial performance. School independence and oversight of ESPs, kind of clarifying some of the legal pieces of that. That's not actually part of this work that we're doing today. And then, of course, a performance framework that's aligned with consequences. That's a critical piece that really is encompassing a number of other elements here, but that's why we're here today, is to discuss the performance framework that we've developed. So without further ado, just three main elements of the performance framework that we're going to discuss, or that you're going to see throughout the life cycle of this project. You've already seen the middle one of the financial framework, and we center that framework around, that section around whether the school is financially viable. The piece that we're going to be focusing on today, where every question, every single measure needs to be able to call back to, is whether the academic program is a success. That's something that you can use as an evaluative tool to be able to analyze the school's academic program. We also have a third framework that's in the works, coming soon, which is the organizational framework that addresses organizational effectiveness, and that's a little bit more aligned with schools' adherence to compliance requirements and laws and some of the elements that actually you already have in place in practice with some of the work that Deanna's office is doing. Just to give you a little bit of background on where we started with this project, NACSA is working with a number of other authorizers nationwide as well on this, in developing a generic framework, which is very general and encompasses a number of key measures that we have seen to be very useful. And we've taken that and adapted it considerably for the Arizona context, again, with the help of the association, which has been integral to this testing period, where we've been able to adapt and address the concerns and the shifting and changes of the performance framework. We have made adaptations and retested the framework. And so we're doing that. We have been able to do this on a continuous process so that we feel fairly confident in the measures that we're providing to you today. And then at the point where we're at today is where we discuss a finalization of this. Discussing the last stages of the framework and the guidance document that would support that framework, so that the staff has the proper direction for implementing the framework itself. So the guidance document that I'm referencing is something that's in the materials that you have. It's very detailed, but it is in a draft form. And some pieces that are elements of methodologies that we are finalizing development of are going to be included in there, as Deanna had mentioned, that will be included as this continues to improve. But overall, this is a fairly comprehensive document that has a lot of detail that we can that we will reference during discussion to make sure that we point folks in the direction of, yes, this is definitely something that we discuss, and it's a document that you see in front of us that you have, you know, that you and the organization has those tools in place to effectively implement. So we're going to walk through now the academic framework in detail. We are going to walk through specifically the traditional academic framework first. We do have a separate framework for the alternative schools, and so we will discuss that as well. We also make modifications to the traditional framework to incorporate considerations for small schools analysis, and that is mostly in some of our methodological approach, so we'll discuss that as well. So first of all, just to give you a big picture, the purpose of the framework, again, is to determine whether the schools are academically successful and effective. We use information, for the most part, that is publicly available data, and making sure that we're not, we know that it's a preference of this board and that you not be asking and putting additional burdens on the schools. The information that we use are information that you can gather through the state accountability system and that are available to the office currently. Again, record, you know, action steps that that schools may be candidates for, replication or expansion. You may need to do take action on a school in terms of communication of dissatisfactory performance. Also discussing renewal, as well as if necessary in the hard times of conversations around closure. This does tie into all three of the principles and standards for NAFSA, just to kind of point us to the best practices nationally, maintaining high standards, upholding school autonomy, and also protecting the student and public interest. So each element of the framework, we're going to walk through a number of different measures. So I want to kind of key us into the vocabulary that we're going to use today because it is useful in really fully comprehensively understanding this framework. The indicators are the broad categories that we use to define academic performance. We have four main categories that we'll discuss. An example is student achievement or status. We will talk through each of those four indicators or those buckets of measures. But then we also have the general means to evaluate the indicator are a group of measures. So we have then within those buckets, there's a group of measures that we use that will help us to provide a better understanding of the school's performance. Within the measures are how we actually quantify the analysis. So we discuss metrics as a means. So when we adjust the methodology, we're often adjusting the metrics. Sometimes we end up adjusting or discussing the different targets or the thresholds that signify performance and meeting the standards. And then, of course, the ratings are the labels that we use to characterize that performance. There are four specific ratings that we use for the academic performance framework. And I'm going to get into a little bit more detail in that just so that we all have a good grounding around what this means for individual measures, but mainly what it means on a cumulative case as well for overall. So for exceed standards, we're saying that if the school is really exceeding performance expectations, that they're exemplar. So this is a high bar. And it's meant to be that way, so as to set the expectation for high quality performance and also to be able to provide the board with the information that they would need to provide some freedoms to that school that might be consistently exceeding standards. Meeting the standard means that the charter holder is meeting the minimum expectations, so they're doing an excellent job. Meeting the standard is where we want to see, of course, we want to see all of the schools at that point. So this is a critical bar, this is the critical point of meeting expectations. Does not meet the standard means that you're failing to meet the minimum expectations and that it's not, you're not making sufficient progress towards those expectations to set forth in this framework. It means that you're below the bar. You may not be at a point where you're the lowest in the state or you're the lowest that you're really, really struggling, but you haven't quite met that standard. Now, this could be something where, if consistently seen across the board, this could be an area where there might be cause for additional information requested to learn more about the performance, to finding out whether, or this could be a point of intervention where you communicate dissatisfaction, but it might not be a point where you're immediately concerned about performance. Falls far below the standard is falling far below the performance expectations, and you're on par with the lowest performing schools in the district and state. So we've tended to set this measure, in some places we set it at a comparative measure so that we are able to say, that schools that fall into this category do actually fall fairly far below what the average would be or what the state composite is. These are the four indicators for academic performance in the performance framework. So recalling that I had talked about the highest level of categorization is indicator, and then we go measure, metric, target. These are the buckets. So you've got four buckets we're looking at: student progress over time, so growth; student achievement or status, so we're looking at mainly proficiency analysis; state accountability, which is your state grading system; and then post-secondary readiness, measures of post-secondary readiness are for high schools only, but they're indicators of likelihood of success in post-secondary and readiness for post-secondary education. So this is a broad view of the academic framework for the traditional schools and the small schools. Recall I said we'll talk about the alternative schools down the road. This is the traditional small schools. This is a kind of a key starting point. And these are each of the measures and the metrics for how we're actually analyzing these areas. So for student growth, there are two measures. One is adequate growth, overall adequate growth, or student growth percentile. And we'll discuss, again, we're going to get into great detail on what these mean as we walk through this whole framework. The second measure is adequate growth for the lowest 25%. So we essentially take a subgroup of the school and take a look at the lowest 25% of students. The student achievement or status indicator has three measures. There's an overall school-wide student proficiency measure. There is also a comparative proficiency, which we are terming as a statewide composite, and we'll discuss what that looks like. But essentially, it's a similar analysis. So students in my school compared on a statewide to students that are demographically similar. And then we look at individual subgroups as another comparative analysis so that you can dig into individual subgroup analysis and better understand schools' performance for those eligible subgroups. The third indicator of state accountability is the state grading system. This is simply the state grade that the school receives. And then the post-secondary readiness measures include graduation rate, and we're tying that to the governor's recommendations for targets. Again, we'll discuss the exact ways that we determine phasing that in, but there's targets for 2020 graduation rates. SAT performance, SAT and ACT performance and participation, this is tied to national averages, but we also make sure that we include a measure of participation as well to ensure that there's a quality check here on this measure so that you know that you've got a good quantifiable chunk of students that you're analyzing. And then a third is credit accumulation, if students are on track for graduation based on their credit accumulation. So we're going to go into each of these, as I mentioned, each of these measures in good detail. So we're going to start with these first two that are the student growth progress over time. I'm going to hand the baton over to Lyria, who's going to discuss for us some of the specific methodological approaches that we use and discuss the targets that have been set for each of these measures. And also I'll jump in there when necessary.
Great, so for student progress over time, as Katie said, there are two measures of growth. They are both, for the traditional schools, they are both based on the Arizona growth model. What we look at is first an overall performance for the students in the school, and then we look at the student growth percentiles for the lowest 25% of students within the school, or the lowest quartile. To give a brief review of the Arizona growth model, For each student across the state, a student growth percentile is calculated. And this is a comparative measure. It looks for each individual student. It takes into consideration their starting point so that low-performing or non-proficient students are, their growth is compared to the growth of other of their peers with the exact same starting point. Likewise, high-performing students who are either proficient or advanced, their growth is compared to the growth of their peers. And this is important because the growth rates, depending on where students start in terms of their proficiency level, there can be a great variation in what you would expect the growth to be. So this is fair both to low performance, you know, school students and schools with low performance as well as high performance. The metric that is used within the framework is a median student growth percentile. So it's looking within a school, what is the median value of student growth percentile? And we wanted to just give a brief way to interpret that. A school with a median student growth percentile of 50 would indicate that at least half the students are making growth that would be above their peers, greater than their peers. Likewise, if you had a school median of 35, that would indicate that two-thirds of the students are performing below their peers across the state. So it gives you a view of how the students as a whole are doing, and as a snapshot, as a snapshot of growth within that school. So the first measure of growth, again, is looking at school-wide. So looking at all the students in the school, what is the school median growth percentile? And the targets that are used here are ones that have been referenced, that are frequently referenced or used with the student growth percentile model. Exceeding the standard would be that at least two-thirds of the students in your school are showing growth above their peers across the state. Likewise, the falls far below, two-thirds of the students are actually performing or have growth that is below their peers. We have set as the meet standard, or what you what would be expected as the bar for charter school performance, would be that at least half of the students in the school are performing as well as their peers. The second measure looks at the lowest performing students within the school. And this measure is included so that those lowest performing students, their growth isn't masked by the growth of the entire student population. So the exact same metric is applied to those lowest performing schools. We're looking at that lowest quartile as a group. How does their growth compare to their peers across the state? And again, it's important to remember that because this is a peer-based metric that starts from the individual school level, each of those individual students is, again, always being compared to their peers. So it's always a fair comparison in terms of evaluating the growth.
And just to reiterate, here, in this sense, we mean the same starting point of performance for the student. So peers in terms of academic performance.
Can I ask a burning question? So I'm going to use language I shouldn't use because I'm not a statistician and I don't really understand it. But so I've been told that normal, by somebody at the association, that normal growth is one standard deviation away from the median, which would be 33-66. That we should consider to be normal growth. Is that not accurate?
Well, that is what is oftenly referred to as typical growth, that it would fall between those ranges. Because there is a need to do, if you think about the definition of what the median is, there's a great difference between a median of 62 and a median of 39. Mm-hmm. So the danger in what we've done is provided you another cut point within that very large group of growth. Because there's a very big difference between a school with 64 and a school with, a 39.
Yeah.
And you're going to be seeing this over time and be able to see the trend of these growth And it does not give you much ability to distinguish academic performance or acceptable growth rates if you have such an enormous growth.
I agree with you. I just wanted, is that controversial at all? I mean, are other states adding this cut point in the middle?
Yes, there are definitely a number of frameworks that have adopted these exact same, algorithms who have adopted the exact same cut points.
And just to clarify, it's not as though we're not saying normal growth is in that within that range. We're setting outside of the normal growth. We're saying you either have exceptional or you have falls far below. So we're not losing that normal growth. We're just adding another cut in the middle to provide for the, that nuanced difference that Lyria mentioned between the school that's got 35 and a school that's got 64.
And then the prior calculation is the full population, is that correct? So the schools in the lowest 25% would be a part of that first calculation?
Yes,
okay.
Exactly. The next indicator is student achievement. And as Katie said, this involves an evaluation of student proficiency rates, and the framework provides three different evaluations of proficiency to provide a nuanced and complete view of the proficiency within the school, proficiency rates within the school. So first we're looking at the overall proficiency of each school in math and in reading. And I should say also that each of the growth measures are also considered separately for math and reading. So proficiency rate for the school is compared to average statewide performance. So as the MEET standard, a school's proficiency rate is compared to the statewide average. And that's set as sort of the meeting standard bar. In order to call out, these are comparative targets that have been created for this measure. Exceeds would be schools whose students are showing performance in the top 10% of the state, and the falls far below would be proficiency rates that are in the bottom 20% of statewide performance. Now, this does take, the methodology used for this metric does take into consideration grades served by the school, because there are, there can be significant differences in proficiency rate as from grade to grade. That is taken into consideration, so that a school would only be compared to statewide averages that include the grades that they serve. Deanna just mentioned that there is quite a bit of additional methodological information within the guidance. We're trying to give you a high-level view here. We certainly can, when we've gone through, address any questions that you have about specific methodology, but didn't want to bog you down too much, but happy to answer questions. The one other thing to note with the target set here is that for the exceed standard, there is an additional target set that if a school is has 90% of its students proficient, it would automatically be considered in the exceed category. And that was in discussions with Deanna and other staff, that was felt that was a bar of excellence that they wanted to maintain. Okay, in addition to looking at just how the overall school proficiency compares, it's important to see how the school is doing given the student population that it's serving. So in order to evaluate, answer that question, how is the school doing given the specific population and the proportions of different types of students that it's serving, we look at the school's proficiency rate compared to a statewide composite. And I'm going to move forward to a little description here. Using statewide student level data, a composite comparison is created that mirrors the demographics served by the charter school in question, so that the charter school can be compared to a composite composed of the exact same percentage of students in the grade levels that it serves, and serving the subgroups that are listed here, students who are qualified for free and reduced lunch, or English language learners, or students with disabilities. We'll talk later on, after we've walked through the measures in the traditional framework, about the alternative framework and modifications for alternative and small schools, but we will just note here that that is taken into consideration in this composite comparison. The final measure of proficiency is an evaluation of the performance of subgroups within the school. So for each of the subgroups, free and reduced lunch, ELL, and special education, the performance, the proficiency rate of those subgroups are compared to the statewide performance for those subgroups. And again, because proficiency rates can vary significantly by grade level, that grade level enrollment at the charter school is taken into consideration when making this comparison to the state.
And just to note, these targets or these cut points mirror that of the overall proficiency rate. So we're just taking and looking at, a magnifying glass, looking a little bit more closely at the subgroups, but we've got the same cut points or expectations.
Okay, the third indicator is state accountability, and in this, for this indicator and this measure, it is a direct reference to the A through F rating received that this school has received on the state A through F rating system. So we're moving on pretty quickly. That's just a direct reference to the school's rating from the state system. The final indicator covers post-secondary readiness. This would be applied to high schools. The first measure, we have graduation rate. As Katie said, as you walked through these briefly, we have graduation rate, we have SAT or ACT performance, and then credit accumulation. So the graduation rate, this is based on the four-year cohort method calculation. And what we have here are the sort of endpoint 2020 graduation rate targets that are based on the governor's graduation targets. That's with a meet standard of 93%, that being the main published and stated target for graduation. We have been looking at current year graduation rates, and based on those, plan to or would recommend adopting a set of phased-in graduation targets so that these rather ambitious targets are not being applied immediately, but you would have a set of phased-in targets that would essentially start taking into consideration current year's graduation rates and then phase in towards this set of ultimate targets.
And just to note, in the guidance document and in the frameworks themselves, which are an appendix to the guidance document, we actually spell out that recommended phase in. We don't have it up here just because it's a crazy table with a lot of years to get to 2020, but just note that that is actually in the detail of the frameworks that you're considering.
Okay, the second measure of post-secondary readiness looks at the ACT or SAT scores for the charter schools. And I'm going to skip ahead and then I'll come back in a moment. Both the College Board and ACT have established benchmarks that are in large-scale research projects established what the benchmark scores on the SAT and the ACT are that correlate to post-secondary success in college or university. So these scores are on the ACT, a composite score of 21 is associated with a 50% chance of earning a B or higher in college, or a 75% chance of a C or higher. And Likewise, similarly, for the SAT, the College Board has established that a composite score of 1550 indicates a 65% likelihood of achieving a B or higher in the first year of college. So these are commonly used benchmarks for SAT and ACT performance. I'm going to go back now to the targets. Depending on whether SAT or ACT scores were used in the framework, there would be some different set point or expectations of percentage of students. So there's a reference here to the national averages of meeting those standards, which for the SAT are 41% of students nationwide in 2011 met those standards, and for ACT I believe it was 25% of students met those benchmarks. So we've constructed some targets that allow for the use of either SAT or ACT with a reference to meeting or exceeding those by up to 20% or being below, falling below by up to 20%. It's important when considering ACT or SAT scores to also consider participation rates on the assessment. You could easily have schools that have very high performance rates on the SAT or ACT, but could have only 5, 10, or 15% of their students participating in the assessment. So it is important to also consider the participation rates on those assessments. These targets that are here are based on average nationwide college and university attendance rates. Where the final measure included for post-secondary readiness is credit accumulation. This is something that was of great interest to many of the staff and stakeholders. So this is something that was recommended to be included, but data have not been available to evaluate in terms of setting targets. So this is something that should be considered. It's a recommended measure, but the targets do need to be developed. Okay.
Maybe we should pause real briefly before we jump into the alternative school framework as well and take a deep breath. Any glaring questions for the traditional framework? Again, we're going to discuss the trial and run analysis as well as weighting of the framework overall. But I want to be able to take a second and pause on the traditional before we jump into very important modifications and additions for alternative schools that we included in an alternative framework.
You know, I just had a question. I read something the other day that more kids were taking the ACT to get into college versus the SAT because they were getting higher grades on the ACT. Do you have any advice for considering that? Because you were saying the SAT or the ACT, like how would you account for that in this? And is one better than the other? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the benchmarks that are used here are based on actual performance on ACT and SAT, and then their correlation, those score performance correlations to success in college. So I think that's taken into consideration if you adopt targets that reference those benchmarks for performance. There can be, so I don't think you need to have a concern in the way that these metrics and targets are constructed. There is a consideration practically how to, incorporate the, or be considering either SAT or ACT. So there are a number of data accessibility issues that I think we can discuss later.
There's a lot to consider with the post-secondary readiness. The real thing that we have access to the data now is graduation rate, and that's really it. You have to consider also that across the country there are other states that require the SAT or the ACT participation, and we don't. And so the schools don't get funded for this assessment either. So, as we look at how it gets incorporated or if it gets incorporated, I think we need to take into consideration that how it would play out, given that there isn't any funding for the schools. There are schools, we do have schools that do pay for it. We do have schools that, you know, are test centers as well, but not everybody does do that. And so I think that needs to be weighed in. And just a little bit on the credit accumulation, what is that? Looking toward the fact that even though it's not being done with a smile, our schools are currently required to report their teachers, their students, their teachers, course numbers. And I think that in preparation for that, we'll be able to link that to into course assessments with PARC, and that it may be another indicator that we can use in the future. It can also be used for alternative schools in determining whether or not they're catching kids up through which courses they're taking and if they're completing those courses. But that is very, very preliminary at this point, which is why it's completely blank, but was thrown in there. So I think as you look through the post-secondary, there's a lot of discussion that could be had about whether or not you want to incorporate SAT and ACT testing and to what level and how, given that there isn't funding to support the administration of that test across all high school students.
And just to add to when we get to the weighting scheme, you'll see that we have essentially incorporated those considerations and that those measures are preliminary at this point. They don't have a weight in the framework, so they're not considered in the overall. But are still measures that are critically important to kind of push for and drive for a more comprehensive picture of post-secondary readiness that is critically important. Any other questions on the traditional framework before we jump into the alternative?
One other piece that I do want to share is that when we met with the subgroups, we talked a lot about the comparative schools, the similar schools, which they liked a lot. But the reality is when we got into the data and the actual comparison and finding schools that were a close enough match, didn't work. So this composite idea that's being presented to you today is a relatively new concept that the stakeholders have not had consideration of in the past.
Could you go back to the ACT-SAT slide? The one where,
okay, I think it's
that one.
Yeah, this one or this one?
That one.
Yeah.
So explain to me what, I think, so the percentage of students, if you look at meets the standards, percentage of students meeting benchmarks for college readiness, right? Meeting the college readiness benchmark.
Right.
So I would meet the standard if the percentage of my kids who meet the benchmark exceeds 20% above the national average.
Right, so if we look at SAT, for example, SAT is, the national average is 41%, the last published meeting that standard of 1550 on the SAT.
Okay.
So to be in the meet standard, you would be between 41 and 60. And if you were had 60% of your students, you would be, or no, I'm sorry, it's a percentage, so what's 20% of 40, so it would be 8, so it would be 41 to 49% of your students, you'd be in the meet standard, and if you had 50% of your students above, you would be a C.
Okay.
This is one that can also be simplified as some of the practical measures, because if you knew, for example, we'll use the ACT. These can be much more clear-cut and tied to specific numbers.
Yeah.
We had to stay a little broad here to include both SAT and ACT.
In a general sense, to meet the standard, the students are, what you're looking for is that your students are as good as the national average or better in terms of college readiness.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree with the principle behind it for sure. I just wanted to make sure.
The methodology is great.
Yeah, and the wording of it's complicated, but I think I understand it. Did we cover the state label part of it? Did we have a slide on that, or was that?
We did, and all we did here was you look at the state letter grades, and we said, okay, if an A is exceeding and a B meets the standard, then the C would be below, and a D and an F would be falling far below.
So that strikes me as sounding wrong. I mean, that a C, which is supposed to be satisfactory, we say doesn't meet the standard. And I wonder, but I guess in my sense, I mean, why do we need this at all? I mean, why do we just, because basically everything that goes into the state accountability grade level system, we're incorporating within this anyway.
You are incorporating it, but you're incorporating it in different ways. So you're using like the weighted student count for your proficiency rates are going to be different. There were some differences when we get to the alternative schools. We're looking at the improvement points, looking at those differently. We're looking at the persistence a little bit differently too, I think. And so it was a matter of, it was an opportunity because you have schools that come back before you and say, but the state labeled me this way. And so it was, yep, you took that into consideration as well, and that's how much value you gave it if you chose to. If you choose not to, that's certainly your choice, but that was the idea behind considering it. And looking at what you had determined in the past as far as your quality schools and those that met your levels as far as being exempted from submitting additional materials and stuff, wasn't sure that a C school met that criteria, and so cut that at the meets being a B, but certainly can be discussed as well.
And one thing that might be a good consideration as another piece to this puzzle is the trial run results that we'll share too, so you can see the breakout of the percentage of charter schools that fell in each category that might help.
It also gets around discussion on the weighting as well. So the weighting on this, I think, largely is like 5% of the overall deposit.
I guess if it were weighted, in my mind, I feel like what we're doing is we're trying to take the raw data that's presented to us that we get and create a better system, or the best system that we can come up with in order to judge the performance of our schools. It just seems unnecessary to throw in the states into it. If we're taking the same data and reorganizing it, then why throw their organization of it in too?
Peter. I think that I do worry about, because it is out there as such a publicly available and talked about, that we will face what we saw before on the school saying, you know, we were a C or a high C or whatever, and here you are. And so I think the weighting is, I agree with you, that how we want to weight all the other factors should be more important, but I think we have to incorporate it at some level.
Yeah.
Or else we're setting ourselves up for that ongoing sort of rub.
I'm okay, if we put it in here, I get really nervous about saying that a C doesn't meet the standard when a C by definition is supposed to meet the standard. I mean, it's satisfactory. That's what I tell kids. You're doing good. You got a C.
So I guess the question is then, as you look at what benefit you want to give to schools who meet your standard, are you going to consider allowing a C school to replicate? Would they get through your renewal process without providing any additional information? I mean, those kinds of things would, and it would depend on how it's weighted, because you wouldn't do it based on one thing. It would be your overall performance, but just something to consider.
But alternatively, you could contemplate using the actual number itself instead of the state rating, right? So if it's 210 gets you a C, then
I'm just throwing that out. In other states, so that is an option.
Yeah, it has a score of 120 on the
The alternative where your cut's different than
that's a great idea. And our cut can be, you know, C plus. Just a couple more quick ones. And then is this where we should open it up, Deanna, to public on this part of the framework, or did you want to wait until we get?
No, I think we need to get further along.
Okay. Does the PARC test, does this look forward ahead to the PARC test? Are they going to calculate growth percentiles in a similar fashion that we'll be able to use?
It's my understanding that that we will be able to use, that we built this language so that the proficiency rates and the growth, we'll be able to transition that language right over to the PARC assessments.
And we adopted a position in the student growth percentiles on the full academic year versus non-full academic year issue that we hear about occasionally from schools.
The system that we developed with the methodology is we adopted the full academic year definitions, both as they've been defined by the State Board of Ed. So a full academic year for a traditional school or a small school would be those students that enroll in the first 10 days, and a full academic year for the alternative schools is by October 1.